Hello, and welcome to the Deciphering Infectious Diseases podcast. My name is Ian Benz, Associate Professor of Elementary Science Education at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and I will be your host as we explore the cutting-edge science being done here at CIFER, the Center for Computational Intelligence to Predict Health and Environmental Risks. CIFER is an interdisciplinary research center at UNC Charlotte that was created to coalesce expertise in computer science, bioinformatics, software and information systems, biological sciences, math, geography, public health, data science, education, and communications. Our goal is to advance the cutting-edge field of molecular epidemiology to better understand and protect against emerging infectious diseases that threaten human health and the environment. If that went way over your head, don't worry. You're not alone. This stuff is complicated, but we're going to break it down each week into bite-sized pieces so that by the end of this season, you'll be as excited about this work as we are. In this first episode, I'll be talking with the two co-directors of CIFER, Dr. Dan Janis and Dr. Adam Reitzel. We'll dive into the origins of CIFER and unpack what molecular epidemiology is all about. You'll learn how this approach represents a paradigm shift from traditional epidemiology by directly analyzing the genetic code of pathogens. This technique is being used not only to treat current diseases, but to predict future pandemics and hopefully stop them before they happen. Dan and Adam will explain how CIFER melds cutting-edge genomic sequencing capabilities with powerful computational techniques like artificial intelligence to model the functional impacts of mutations on protein structures. You'll hear about their vision of progressing to functional molecular epidemiology, peering into the molecular machinery of life to predict how genetic changes will affect real-world outcomes. We'll also explore the interdisciplinary collaborative nature of CIFER, how combining diverse expertise across domains like computer science, biology, public health, and science communication allows them to tackle problems too complex for any individual field. Dan and Adam will share insights into the innovative design of the CIFER facilities to promote this cross-pollination of ideas and team science approach. So join me for a fascinating discussion into the frontier of molecular epidemiology research. You'll gain an appreciation for how CIFER and this field are working to get ahead of the curve on emerging infectious disease threats, enabling proactive monitoring and response rather than playing catch-up to each new crisis. Whether you're someone impacted by COVID-19, concerned about the next pandemic, or simply curious about revolutionary science, you won't want to miss this insightful conversation. So hi, Dan and Adam. Can you kind of talk to us about what CIFER is? Where did it come from? What was the impetus for starting CIFER? And first of all, what does CIFER stand for?
CIFER is an acronym for the Center for Computational Intelligence to predict environmental and health risks.
Okay.
So we have a pretty big mandate.
All right. So let's dig into that. What do you see as your mandate for this center?
We're a computational center and an empirical center. We use, by and large, the modalities of, you know, genomic sequencing of viruses and bacteria and other pathogens, and computation and microscopy as well, to figure out what those mean. We see a lot of emergent disease coming from, you know, zoonotic disease, which means it comes from animals. So the relationship between the bacteria, the viruses, the animals, their environment, and how that process of zoonosis occurs all can be studied with these modalities. And so that's what we're trying to understand. And so we're not a pandemic response center. We're, although SARS-CoV-2 has been incredibly important and eye-opening, we're really an all-hazard center. We have experts in vector-borne diseases, tick-borne diseases, for example, experts in bacteria, experts in viruses, experts in fungi, experts in animals that carry these diseases, and experts in sort of the system of how diseases in the environment and animals interact. And Adam, that's a good segue to Adam's area.
Yeah, so, you know, we can talk about, thanks, Dan, and we can talk about the pathogens that are impacting humans, but yeah, where do they come from? You know, Dan was saying, what are the other animals that are vectoring them, that harbor them at a portion of their life cycle? And also, you know, these emergent pathogens that are affecting non-human animals, agricultural plants, et cetera. So we're taking a broader scope look at what are those pathogens, where are they coming from, and how do they evolve?
Okay. So what kind of impact does that have on like the general public? And we're all right now, we're going to be constantly thinking about the COVID pandemic, but so you can think about that in your response, but more of the future with this type of work. Can we kind of talk more specifically about, you mentioned, Dan, vector-borne diseases. Can we talk more about that? What is that?
Yeah. Well, the most recent one people would be concerned about would be that was newsworthy was Zika virus. Okay. So this is a rare disease out of, out of Africa that started to infect different mosquitoes and started to travel, oddly enough, across the Pacific, had a very strange pathology of when a pregnant mother was infected with this virus, it caused microcephaly in the fetus. It was a terrible outcome. And we didn't notice it because it was sort of hop, skipping, and jumping through these small populations in the Pacific. But then when it hit a continental country, Brazil, the rare pathology was enough in numbers to be noticed. And Zika virus actually spread throughout the Caribbean, Latin America, did start to occur in Miami, and was stamped out right away. But these kinds of things are happening over and over again. And, you know, we've dodged a few bullets, but certainly we didn't dodge the SARS-CoV-2 bullet. So.
Okay. And you mentioned something, you know, one of you mentioned, you know, wet labs, computational labs. Can we pick apart that? What are wet labs and what are computational labs, and how do those, you know, how do you use them in your work?
Yeah. So, you know, I'd say that was built into the design of the center. So Dan and I spent a lot of time working with architects and planners in the university for how to best design the space for the team research focus of the Cypher Center. So for like the wet labs is maybe what most people would think of as a science lab. You know, it has equipment and reagents. You know, there's not usually bubbling solutions, but, you know, that's kind of what you might think of as a laboratory. So that's where people are primarily generating the data from some of these samples that we've referred to. And then for the computational labs, or what we call a dry lab, is sort of a team-focused space for work around in computers, around high-throughput computing. And so it's not just people sitting in front of their computer alone. We think that science is done more quickly and more creatively in teams. And so we've sort of designed these spaces for that team focus around particular projects.
Okay. Let's talk about that team aspect of things. So what does Cypher allow us to do on the university that maybe we weren't able to do before? Who does it bring together?
It really formalizes various disciplines, certainly computation and chemistry, DNA sequencing. You know, universities are built on departments which are within colleges, and we have other responsibilities. We all have departments in which we teach, and we seek career advancement through academic affairs. But here in the center, we don't do those activities. We just do the research together. So we're trying to bring people in with different mindsets to attack these problems, which are complex problems, as we illustrated through the animal-environment pathogen interactions, attack them from different points of view. So it might be biology, by and large education now, which is what we're doing right now. It'll be computer science as well. It can be chemistry, can be pathology, can be entomology for the insects, and so forth.
Okay. Adam, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I just add on that in that sort of department college structure is also department and college buildings. And so it can result in, the sort of a siloing effect of knowledge, expertise that when you're physically located in the same physical space, that sort of synergism and those opportunities for novel ideas and interactions just come much easier. And so I think that physical space here at Cypher really expedites those interactions and outcomes.
Okay. I've heard someone actually talk to me about this when in preparing, you know, trying to get ready for today's conversation. You know, there are probably a lot of people out there who really don't know what they don't know, but why it is they need to know this stuff. And I've actually had a friend describe it as it's like weather forecasting for diseases, you know, especially when you see the computational part. But we know it's a lot more than that. Can you kind of expand on that idea of what is it we don't know and why do we need to know what it is that Cypher's doing?
Yeah. May I field that?
Mm-hmm.
Because historically, if you looked at the field of epidemiology, that's counting the cases, and the cases are defined by symptoms. So if you got a report, you know, pre-H1N1 influenza, you know, say in the mid-2000s, if you got a report from your county epidemiologist, they're counting the number of cases of people who have respiratory illness, fevers, maybe gastrointestinal symptoms, and those symptoms are caused by 30 or 40 different pathogens, and some not even pathogenic cases like COPD. And that pie chart, if you will, of these different causes changes over time and space. The percent that is actual influenza may be, 10%, and the rest might 90% might be other things, cold viruses, or these benign coronaviruses that we experienced before SARS-CoV-2. So what has happened really since H1N1 is our way of looking at disease has flipped. We've gone from sort of traditional epidemiology to molecular epidemiology, where we're breaking open that pie chart, getting the genetic material of all the pathogens, and really looking at every slice of the pie chart and figuring out what's important. So looking at it not from a clinical counting the number of respiratory illnesses, but a biological point of view and looking at the pathogen itself. And that's really taken off with being able to study small variations in SARS-CoV-2 as it evolved in the human population over the past 4 years, and what those imply. And now we're at a whole new era. And I'll pause for a minute, but I'll tell you about that new era.
Yeah. Adam, what did you want to add?
I would add that then whenever we then look in the environment and we look at, you know, species that that we care about for economic reasons, tourism reasons, we can think of agricultural plants, we can think of coral reef ecosystems. It becomes even murkier there that we, it's kind of the epidemiology case Dan was referring to. We see dead corals and live corals, but with maybe no indication of what the pathogen, which could be a bacteria, a virus, a fungus. And so without this sort of DNA sequence-based approach for identification of those candidate pathogens, we're totally in the dark about the mechanisms that's actually resulting in that death of that coral reef, et cetera. So, you know, as Dan said, this is a really flipped way at looking at identifying these pathogens and then trying to, or at least potential pathogens, try to hone in on solutions for, you know, that species or that ecosystem, et cetera.
What we've experienced now is, I'm a big proponent of molecular epidemiology. I'm a big proponent of, you know, sequencing these. We created the center around those ideas. But what's happened, what's really gotten interesting with SARS-CoV-2 variants is when Omicron came out, we were surprised. Okay, 30 some mutations in a very short period of time. Because previous to that, Alpha and Delta, the other variants, they only had a few mutations. They were meaningful mutations. But 30, wow. And that really changed the structure of Omicron and its spike protein. And because Omicron was so different from the variants upon which the vaccines were designed, that's why there was so much breakthrough infection. Fast forward to, you know, 2023-24, there are more variants, and the news always picks up on these, especially if they have a lot of mutations. But one of the things we found out through structural biology and artificial intelligence is it's not just counting the mutations. These JN1 variants that are common now, for example, they're descendants of Omicron with yet another 36 mutations or so. But we found out through structural biology fueled by artificial intelligence that the current vaccines are still going to be efficacious against them. And so it's different. So it's not just counting the mutations, in short. We have to look at the functional implications of those mutations. And that's a whole nother layer. I thought molecular epidemiology had come far, but now we're going a whole nother layer of functional molecular epidemiology, which I think is going to be very exciting.
You mentioned artificial intelligence, and I wanted to talk about that some. What role has that had in your work up to this point? What do you see as it potentially, you know, how will it change the field for both of you? I mean, where do you see it going?
Shall I?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. So yeah, it means all kinds of things, right? And you can use AI to write papers. You can use AI to do better pattern recognition. The way we use it is it's through, you know, the Google-funded project out of the European Molecular Biology Lab called AlphaFold. And that is a program that really shocked the bioinformatics world because structural biology was largely going from a raw sequence, ACs, Gs, and Ts, right, or protein, and folding that and understanding what or predicting what that fold should be in the three-dimensional structure of the protein and then figure out the implications of that, those changes. That was approached largely through brute force, through high-performance computing, just throwing more computation at it. What the AlphaFold project has done is say, we'll just bootstrap up on all other known structures, you know, and it can be done with much less computation, much faster and much more accurately. And I was very healthily skeptical of all these, AI advancements because they weren't normal for our education, right? But once we superimposed the structure of AlphaFold versus the empirically derived structure for Omicron's spike protein, boy, I was convinced that there was a big breakthrough. And my colleagues who did work in structural biology for the past decades just said they had to completely throw out their old methods and adopt these new methods. So I got convinced by, you know, hook or crook that at least in this field, artificial intelligence is going to be very important.
What about with you, Adam, and the type of work that you're doing? Do you see it impacting you at all?
Yeah, we haven't heavily engaged with AI yet. I mean, we've the AlphaFold program that Dan referred to, we use that routinely for looking at for sort of a deeper evolutionary history of particular proteins that are involved in immune systems. Mm-hmm. So we have used it for some of these predictive models at looking at conservation of protein structure and thus to guide experiments looking at function. But we're kind of new to it. I guess I'm old in my ways and I'm slow to adapt, but we see a lot of promise for it. We're really just getting it started.
So what have you learned? So first of all, when did Cypher officially launch? When did we officially open? Do you remember?
January 2023 is when we occupied the building. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we were on the books before as a center.
Right. But the physical space.
University of North Carolina. Yeah.
Right. So we were already a center at UNC Charlotte prior to the physical space opening in January of 2023. What have you learned in this first year and a half almost, now that we've been in the space? What has it been like? What have you learned from it? What can we take from it to inform future decisions, future work?
Dan, do you want to go for it? That's a big question.
Yeah. I think it's an evolution of how science works. We're just making it convenient or easy or taking advantage of this movement towards team science that we talked about earlier, in a sense, creating spaces that are conducive to it. And one is the computational lab. And that's a long story. We were working with the architects and they asked how we work. They wanted to know, our daily lives. And I said, well, one of the things that we've done that's very interesting is there's a couple of small conference rooms that we use. And we could use more of those because we use them in akin to like war rooms, right? We'd bring people in from different educational stages, different mindsets. And we have one, it's not a class, it's, you know, one paper or one project. And we bring our work there, but then we have a large screen and an interactive program where we can say, what if we can do a lot of what if scenarios? What if we change the protein? How does the fold of the protein change the structure of the, the fully folded protein? And what does that mean in terms of health, right? Are we going to, our current vaccine is still working. And we can do that almost on the fly and think about it together. And it's been really a way to do things better, faster, you know. And I think the COVID experience, the COVID SARS-CoV-2 pandemic has really put a lot of pressure on biology to do things, you know, better and faster, because if you don't get these results out soon, Omicron will have passed and the next variant will be upon you. And you can publish an academic paper on it, but what good is that information in terms of public health? So
right.
I think these war rooms, or we call them computational labs, but I think they're really important for that. And people have really responded to them. They really like this way of working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the other thing that, you know, really seen over this a little over a year now is just the amount of interaction that just happens spontaneously. I think, as I said, the computational labs have been one place, but yeah, just the hallway conversations mm-hmm. and lab group interactions that are just happening daily. And so just walking the halls is actually really exciting, just to be walking by and you hear someone talking about some new problem and bouncing ideas off each other. That sort of energy has been a ton of fun this past year.
Yeah. We talked about early on, you know, we are traditionally in academia, we're in our own silos. And so when we walk them down the hallways, we hear things people may be talking about, but we, for the most part, have a very similar background and training, different varying levels of, you know, expertise, but still a similar background. How has your understanding of science or particular fields within science changed by working with people from different fields that are now all under Cypher?
Well, yeah. So in certain ways, I think Dan and I were probably, sort of picked for leadership for this because we were kind of thinking across disciplines, mm-hmm. you know, as part of our normal work, right? And so I think part of that is it's been wonderful to now be physically in a space where there's more of that interaction. Where I think some of the uniqueness for me has been, and I'm not just saying this because we're on the podcast, but working with folks like yourself, Ian, that, I think we can think about the science, the bioinformatics, computational sciences, biology, those interactions, which are wonderful. But then I think it's the next layer of interactions about what are ways to share that information? What are mm-hmm. ways to better communicate the findings? That I think that's where folks like yourselves and some of the interactions that we've been able to build with you have been really exciting for thinking about how we get that information out quickly, effectively, and in a language that is going to be effective in the broader community.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I appreciate hearing that because I always have lots of questions and clearly do not have the background that either of you two have. I don't have a degree in biology, but I've got a lot of curiosity about it. And then I always think of how can we take what it is we're learning within science and translate it to an educational setting or just a general public setting so that others can understand it. Yeah, I think that's highly valuable. I've noticed too that, when I walk up and down the halls, when I look at like the nameplates of offices, I see people, right now from math, for example, have an office here, someone like myself from education, data science. So what do you see those others also adding to this, like those conversations being like for you? So take us back into that war room you're talking about, Dan.
Yeah.
And you have someone like me walk in who doesn't have a background.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could think of it like this, like sports, mm-hmm. you have specialists. You have a pitcher and a catcher in baseball. It's baseball season. We'll use a baseball metaphor. And as you advance, those pitchers and catchers don't do any other jobs. They don't even bat, right? the pitchers doesn't even bat. So yeah, we do, expertise has limitations. And so what we're trying to do is combine those expertises into a team that's going to be effective. I may know a lot about, the computation that we need for a system, but I might not know that much about the immunology we need to take those results and interpret them in ways that matter to your personal and public health. So that's where the rubber really hits the road, is those transfers of knowledge between different experts.
What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I just second that. I guess for me, you brought up mathematics, and it's been a long time since I had calculus, differential equations, et cetera. But I think that we have to get a common language around a problem. So that happens more, whenever we're speaking to each other, you say, well, it's like this, and you can draw on the whiteboard if you're old school, or you can get on the computer and try to do it digitally. But I think, so we can have ways to explain a problem or explain a question we have, and then it's getting to a common language with that other expert, with the pitcher and the catcher. They have to be able to, they have to have the same signs, right? Otherwise, they're not communicating with each other. And so I think this sort of makes that process quicker, and also means that we don't have to know everything, because we don't know everything, right? But if we can articulate a problem and a shared problem, and we bring those skill sets to the table together, then we get all those expertise around it, but that are actually communicating with each other effectively.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about infectious diseases. And so just out of curiosity, are there other things that we hope to explore out of Cypher? Is primarily Cypher focused on, the infectious diseases? Or, because it talks about predicting health and environmental risks. So what are potentially other areas that we hope to explore here in Cypher?
I think civic engagement, and that's, why we're doing this. And I think one of the lessons learned among many from the pandemic, some of them, severe lessons learned, I would say, is that people started to not believe science and I think part of it's a translation problem, a communications problem. So we're going to try to work through this podcast and through community organizations to bridge that gap and, get people to trust medicine and science again. Because I think, we've all seen the effects of not participating in wellness is bad, and it damages society.
Right. Adam, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, for sure. Yeah, that we need to do better, and we being the scientific community writ large, right? That so yeah, and I'll just speak personally. That was not part of my training, right? There was no class, there was no engagement activity as a trainee in science. That's like, now go talk about that to the public. Fortunately, that's changing now. I think that's part of the research and better preparing the next generation or the current generation of scientists, right? Which we have a lot of graduate students, undergraduate students, and postdoctoral researchers, so trainees that are here in Cypher. So I think this environment also gives them the ability to sort of practice those skills, to interact with the broader public, not just a number of scientists, which is part of the job, right? But and so I think there's also a training aspect that happens at center, and some of that just happens, right? Because they're here, they're meeting folks. And some of that's that, we're all working on that messaging. And I think Cypher will be a really good catalyst point for that.
Yeah, you asked about surprises. One of the things that has happened is we have a really nice, we're blessed with a beautiful space, and people of all kinds of civic groups and government groups and come to use the space. And so sometimes we're asked to provide short demonstrations and explain ourselves, explain what we're doing. And, so the students are learning as they go how to engage the public and engage our legislators. And I think that is a whole nother level that, was never taught before.
And I think that, some science and training, they're like, well, that's not my job, right? Or that's not what I'm doing this for, right? But I think the events we've had here, especially with the legislature, have been amazing, right? And I think the students and, I think Dan and I, we really enjoy it. It's a really, it's a great interaction. It's part of our mission, right? So the fact that we get to do it is a blessing. It's wonderful.
Well, and I would think too, the experience of having people, like elected officials here, that, we then have to show off the space and what it is that's being done here, that it's important to hear from them the types of questions they would ask, for example. So then that could potentially or hopefully inform, the way you present the work in the future, for example, right? And I could imagine too, if, you know, we get to a point where we could have, you know, elementary school visits or something like that to campus and we bring them up here to Cypher, having them go through and the types of questions that children would ask that obviously others would not could be very informative for us.
Yeah, I was just saying that's part of been the practice over the, you know, it's only been a year, but, you know, we've had a number of iterations of different types of visitors and we put together some demos, you know, some things to show the type of work we do in different ways. And it's been a good practice. I think we've honed some of those. Some of them work and some of them don't, right? And I think it's been an opportunity to hone some of those presentation skills and to kind of pitch it at the right audience in a way that is, you know, is both true to the science, but also interpretable in a way for that, you know, for that particular group.
Right. So throughout this podcast, you know, we'll have other episodes in the future where we are, you know, I'm talking with other people from Cypher, but can we kind of just do a broad overview of who are the people that you have, that we have here? Who are the scientists? And you, Dan, you mentioned postdocs, or one of you mentioned postdocs, grad students, undergrad and stuff. So I think that would be really interesting for the public to understand, like, who is physically here.
Yeah, great.
And what that's like.
And I happen to have a cheat sheet that I'll use. Oh, okay. I'll summarize, or to begin with, we are about 60 people now, and we could be much larger. We could probably carry 100 or so of people working together, which was very exciting. I never envisioned that in my life. You know, Adam and I grew up where you have a, if you have a big lab, you have eight, you know, so 100 is going to be great. So in terms of people working here, we have Rafael Vieira, who works on zoonotic and tick-borne disease. We have Elaine Lowe, who works on viral discovery. Morgan Carter, who works on bacterial-fungal interactions. Abby Labella, who works on fungal pathogens of humans. Dennis Jacob Machado, who works on phylogenetics and artificial intelligence applied to infectious diseases. We have Ian Binns, who is our nature of science educator and podcaster. We have Damian Williams from philosophy, who's an expert in the abatement of health disparities. We have Rick White, who is a virologist. We have Shi Chen, who's an epidemiologist. Adam Reitzel, who works on microbial animal environment interactions. Kevin McGough from Math, who's working on epidemic and evolutionary modeling and infectious diseases. And myself, I work on, largely on interpreting genomic information for health information.
Yeah.
As applied to infectious disease.
Okay. And then most of the people here, you know, most people we talked about were the scientists here or, you know, experts in other, you know, parts of the academy, you know, in academics. But the scientists typically, they all have their own teams or labs. Is that correct?
Yeah. Like, each okay. one of those groups will have, you know, well, the younger people are just building their teams. They'll have, you know, start with two or three students. So they'll have undergraduate students who mm-hmm. are quite welcome and thriving here, really. Graduate students who are attached to their home departments, but they work every day here in Cypher. And postdoctoral fellows who are scientists, young scientists who have completed their PhD, but have yet to join a faculty. And work as, you know, full-time scientists. They're right. just doing research. They don't have academic responsibilities. And then there may be some technical staff who operate the machines and take care of the computers. And we have a fantastic administrator, James, who keeps everything running for us.
Yeah. Yeah, James, that he does. So I want to ask another thing. We've talked about, you know, it's fun to hear about your enthusiasm and excitement, you know, for what's happening here and what could happen. What has it been like talking about Cypher when you are talking with colleagues in your individual fields at either conferences or other meetings? What has that been like when you go there and talk about, hey, this really cool thing's happened at UNC Charlotte that I'm part of?
It's great. Of course, you like to show off. Yeah. Yeah, that's what conferences are for. And so I found I'm showing off in a different way, not just with results, but, you know, I'm sort of learning how to to run things. And I guess, you know, the metaphor I can use, back to metaphors, is I feel a bit like a player coach, and it's been nice to have that new aspect of my career.
Yeah. What about you, Adam?
Yeah. Similarly, it's good to, it's great that we have this wonderful center to show off and to talk about. And I think it's also been good that, to bring researchers from other places here and kind of show them what we have. And they're always like, well, this is, wonderful. I wish we had kind of a place like this, et cetera. So yes, we feel very fortunate just have to keep at it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have space for visitors we're attracting, people to come for working visits.
I want us to kind of think ahead. So say 10 years from now, right? Cypher's still here, hopefully, and we're still doing great things. What is it you hope, if you can envision what it would be like 10 years from now, what do you envision it would be like? And then also what do you hope we will have accomplished by then? What's the goal?
Anything's possible in 10 years, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially with AI and science. And we know how fast it changes and society changes. But yeah, I'm just curious.
I think to complete this revolution of molecular epidemiology to continue it, and now I'll add the word functional molecular epidemiology, such that we're not working in sort of the civic engagement. One of the soapboxes I like to get on is we seem to deal with these infectious disease things as crises that come. We respond to them for better or worse, and then we forget about them, right? So I think with these technologies that allow us to monitor the environment for pathogens emerging, monitor pathogens that are just starting in animals before they get into the human population, I think that will allow us to sort of become much more constitutive. That's a biology word, looking all the time and just responding, instead of responding crisis to crisis. And I think that's going to be really important going forward. And we'll see. I mean, that requires political and political will too. So there's the vision, and then there's the execution thereof. But I would paint that as a success in 10 years if we get that message out.
Adam, do you want to add anything?
I would second that. That would be wonderful. I think that monitoring aspect. I think the both in human and, and then as that kind of then grows out, usually, we get a lot of movement, and this is across science, across biology, we get a lot of movement on sort of human focus for obvious reasons. We're humans, we're most, in most concern, but I think then the sort of halo effect then that happens, a better monitoring of other species, other populations, other parts of the world. I think there's a lot of, in 10 years, I'd like to see that same sort of opportunity then applied to environmental issues as well. Environmental monitoring, where it's already happening with environmental DNA, where people are essentially monitoring different ecosystems, lakes, rivers, oceans, whatever, by using DNA sequencing as sort of the primary window into characterizing those habitats or those ecosystems. So I see a very parallel process that could be happening with human populations and human pathogens. Could have a similar monitoring system for other environments to which we are, which we maybe particularly care about or are focused on.
Can we unpack that some, Adam, a little bit?
Sure,
talk about the environmental, monitoring of environmental, I think you're saying systems, right? Is that right? Am I using the right term?
Yeah. Well, so, if we think about environmental risk, we think part of the acronym for Cypher, mm-hmm. That could have a lot of interpretations, I'm sure, in the same way that health risk could have a lot of foci, maybe not interpretations. But, one thing we could imagine is that if we have a particular, we're usually focused on certain species, right? We think about endangered species, right? Those are sometimes the primary catalyst then for action, legislative, government, whatever it may be. But instead of maybe focusing on single species, maybe we think about the health of that particular ecosystem. And one of the primary characteristics then to understand what is that ecosystem and what's healthy versus not is understanding who's there and who's not and how that changes. doing that with, you know, with sort of the traditional ways of get a net or get a, you know, get a whatever, go out and scoop up everything and then try to identify all those. That's a tremendous amount of not only work, but also expertise. And it takes years and sometimes many years to characterize what all lives in that particular ecosystem, whatever thing you may be most interested in. But by using more of a DNA sequence-based technology, we can use those sequence markers as the indication of, well, what are all the species that are there? How many are there? You know, this environmental impact happens. What left? You know, what's no longer there that we'd likely miss, especially if they're rare species? And many of the endangered, the ones that we may be most interested in and protecting, are typically the rarest ones. And so I think this is a window that a technology has provided that's now being slowly adopted worldwide for environmental monitoring of not only species of interest, but also ecosystems of interest. So I don't know, is that where you're kind of thinking?
Yeah,
along the lines
I just
of?
Find that very interesting. So.
Yeah, so we kind of have some projects that we're spinning up. We're looking at freshwater ecosystems and like the Charlotte region. You know, my group has worked in primarily coastal ecosystems, on ocean coastal ecosystems. And there's just a lot of opportunity there, I think, for Cypher to have have kind of a unique skill set here that can contribute towards those what have been sort of as traditionally environmental conservation monitoring. I think there's a technological angle that adds a whole bunch to that. It doesn't take anything away, but it adds a whole new set of windows to understand what's happening in these ecosystems.
A question I have for you, Dan, and I probably should have asked this earlier, but you may have done it, but what do you mean by, or what is functional molecular epidemiology? Which I'm sure we will unpack more when we meet, but yeah, can we, there's some terms you've used that I think need to be explained.
Molecular epidemiology, I would say, is that first flip of the coin, you know, the other side of the coin. Instead of counting the cases, looking at the actual bugs, okay? Instead of counting the symptoms and the people, which can be caused by many things, breaking that open, looking at the actual pathogens causing the disease, what's important. And then the lesson learned from how many mutations Omicron had, and then again, its descendants, JN1, had, were different. Those mutations had different implications with respect to the antibodies circulating in our bodies. I mean, the first vaccines were designed against early variants of SARS-CoV-2, and Omicron evolved around them. It evaded the immune reaction created by the vaccines. Whereas JN1, with the reformulated vaccines and therapeutic antibodies that are used today, it's mutated a lot, but it has not evaded the defenses we have through vaccination. So the function is different in counting the mutations that didn't get us there. We had to fold the proteins and look at the implications of those folds.
I think we're kind of getting near the end of our time. So, you know, I always like to ask when talking with people if there's anything that I should have asked but didn't. Is there anything that we should have covered in this kind of general overview of Cypher that we didn't cover?
Nothing comes to front of mind for me. I don't know, Dan, how about you?
Yeah, I just think, just reiterate the things that surprised me is, the success of the architecture in promoting team science. That, I mean, we had high hopes, but it seems to be working, which is really refreshing. And this whole new area of, you know, working together across disciplines, even non-science disciplines, reaching out to philosophy and education, such that we can improve our civic engagement and sort of demystify what we do. And hopefully people will take care of themselves and their neighbors with the technology that we can develop.
Right.
And, you know, it's been, you know, we've all experienced this pandemic. And so let's learn from the lessons that we were subject to.
Adam, hearing that, do you have anything you want to add?
Nope. I can't do better than that. So,
all right. Well, thanks both Dan and Adam. It's been fun just to kind of figure out what led to the start of Cypher that, you know, I am now proudly part of. And it's when I'm at my conferences, you know, I've had a few science education conferences that I've either been to or people I've talked with in my community outside of UNC Charlotte and telling them about this, they light up. You know, it's they get really excited about hearing the new things I'm trying to or I'm getting involved in all the different disciplines that I get to interact with on a more regular basis. And people on campus, too, are also just they like to hear about. You know, I'm someone who's just so curious about everything. And so, and obviously science is a science educator. And so it's just, they love to think about what it is we're trying to do up here and where we can go with it. So I'm very grateful to be part of this team as well.
Okay, great. Right on.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks, Zach. Yeah. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Deciphering Infectious Diseases podcast. This episode was produced and edited by Zach Jackson. You can get in touch with us and learn more about Cypher at cypher.charlotte.edu. That's cipher.charlotte.edu. We're always seeking new collaborations, so if you're interested in getting involved or have ideas you'd like to discuss, please reach out. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss future episodes. We'll continue diving deeper into specific research areas, introducing you to other key scientists, and exploring how Cypher is working at the vanguard of infectious disease research. Cypher is a proud part of UNC Charlotte, who holds all rights to the content created by this podcast. From all of us here at Cypher, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.